Welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast, where we explore the intersection of creativity and student learning. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher and current college professor. I'm also the co-author of Launch, Using Design Thinking to Boost Creativity and Bring Out the Maker in Every Student. And here's the thing, I am passionate about seeing schools become bastions of creativity and wonder. I just finished a series on student choice and really the question of what it means to empower students to own the entire learning process. And I'm starting something different. It's kind of about design thinking and creativity, but it's also a lot about something a little bit bigger, and it's the future of learning. And I think a lot of times people are in kind of two different camps that I think are equally dangerous when it comes to technology and the future of learning. Some people get obsessed with the future and they get super excited about it and they kind of blindly run in and jump into the latest, greatest technology. And that's dangerous because that puts novelty ahead of sustainability. And the second approach is almost as dangerous, and it's this idea of being afraid of everything and allowing fear of change and fear of technology and fear of the future to get in the way of progress and to get in the way of really good things that could be done in schools. So I think it's important that we have kind of a mix of skepticism and excitement, that we're not afraid, but that we are wise as we think about this topic. So on today's podcast, I'm going to talk about the 7 technology trends that will transform learning in the next 5 years. Here we go. I knew social media had hit mainstream the moment that my mom sent me a friend request. Suddenly, Facebook became a place where mom and friend were synonymous. I knew that Facebook had lost its cool, edgy college vibe. Any place where your mom is your friend is kind of not a cool place to hang out. Now, since then, Facebook has become such a normal, habitual part of life that we hardly even notice it. I check it in the morning and after I'm done writing or working on projects. I check it when I'm bored in the afternoon. And it's just kind of there. I use it to interact with people. It's where I find, you know, funny videos, things like that. But it's just this normal piece of life. It's what we see all the time. And so it's easy to forget then just how seismic a shift social media has actually been. Each social media platform is a fusion of space and tool. And that's where the concept of space, social, and tool media blend together. When we use a phrase like, I was on Facebook for an hour, we're treating it like it's a physical space, even though it's not. And when we say, my grandma knows how to use Facebook, we're talking about it like it's a tool. But the truth is it really is both. And that wasn't the case in the past. We had places and we had tools. In the past, we weren't present mentally, but not present physically. That just wasn't there. And so this concept of using the places that we inhabit and inhabiting the tools that we use is really kind of strange. And I think we're just now starting to make sense out of it as a culture. But as a classroom teacher, I watched how social media changed student relationships. And some of these felt positive and powerful, like the shift from a social hierarchy to a web of relationships where people could shift between cliques, or with the ability to fight adolescent loneliness by connecting with friends. And these were really, really positive things. But some of the other trends felt more dangerous, like the metrics around relationships, things like counting likes and friend counts and things like that, or the death of boredom and solitude. I worry that as kids become less and less bored, they become less and less creative, because boredom is a critical piece of divergent thinking. For all the talk about the fact that we are you know, less present with one another. The truth is, I think we're actually too present. I think we're always present, always with people. And that can be a real problem. We need to zone out and daydream and be bored. I watch students move from idolizing athletes to venerating YouTube stars. And in the process, kids who had never been interested in science were suddenly relating to Neil deGrasse Tyson or replicating experiments from Steve Spengler. I watch them learn how to do new things that they'd never known how to do before because they're watching videos. And that's really exciting. But I also watched students talk about building brands and starting businesses through social media. And it was kind of hard for me to hear this because my kids were only in the eighth grade. I just wanted them to be kids. So it's been both exciting and terrifying to watch the coming of age of the first generation raised around social media. It has me wondering what technology trends will reshape education in the next 5 to 10 years. Now, a word of caution here. Many of these trends aren't new. In some cases, these are technologies that are just now hitting mainstream. In other cases, they are technologies that have been around for years, but are just now, making a difference in society. And we're just now starting to deal with students who grow up feeling that these tech tools were normal. So, number one, the rise of the curators, or as I like to call them, the geeks who love sharing stuff. It's basically what they are. This is a trend that's already begun. You see it with the rise of blogs like Farnham Street and Brain Pickings. In a world of information overload, curation has become a critical skill. Curation goes beyond simply collecting items online and then sharing it with others. See, the best curators know how to find what is best by immersing themselves in a niche area while making surprising connections between ideas and concepts in seemingly unrelated worlds. Great curators find specific excerpts that are relevant in the moment, but also timeless. They can explain the purpose, the context, and the necessity of what they are citing. Often, a great curator adds a perspective and a lens without quite reaching the place of commentary. Maria Popova has certain points that she illustrates often, but they never feel like talking points. They seem to arise from the material instead of feeling like she cherry-picked the sources and then is, you know, using them to back up her ideas. This has me thinking about schools. I wonder what it would look like for students to learn the art of curation. In a world of constant information, where kids are fooled by an Onion article, curation teaches kids how to be media literate by analyzing sources with a critical eye. However, true curation takes it a step further. And this is what happens when they analyze and categorize, when they identify what's best, and then they share it in a meaningful way. Here they can find trends and share patterns in what they are seeing. They can offer their own unique lens. And that's important because that's the one thing that can't be replaced by a computer or by artificial intelligence. That's the thing that they can offer. Now, number two is the distortion of time. It's become so common that you almost don't notice it. However, on most platforms, news feeds are based upon interest rather than chronology. And that didn't used to be the case. So now, as you scroll down, you aren't looking at the most recent posts to the oldest posts. What you're looking at are posts that might be a day or 2 days or a week old. This might not seem like a big deal, but it's actually a shift away from the linear view of time and toward a more connective, relevance-based concept of time. Another shift involves the blend of asynchronous and synchronous communication. In the past, you had things like phone conversations or video chats, and these were synchronous. They happened in the moment. And then you had things like texting and email, and they were asynchronous. They were things that happened not at the same time, and you kind of had to wait and go back and forth. Now, you're seeing apps right now that blend both the synchronous and asynchronous communication. Take Voxer. You can talk synchronously in the walkie-talkie mode, but you can also listen to it later. And if you're listening to me, you might listen to it on, you know, times two or times three, because I've been accused of being a slow talker, which maybe I am. And you can send pictures back and forth and text back and forth, and you can look back on what was said earlier, and it creates this permanence and temporality that make it unique. Students are now growing up in this age where time and our concept of time is always changing. It's an era where time is compressed and extended, where it is synchronous and asynchronous at the same time, and where it is both linear and connective. I'm curious what this will mean for things like deadlines and project management and collaborative projects. How will students relate to this changing of time that continues to happen? Number three, virtual reality. You're already seeing this in the initial sparks of virtual reality, and this is with the popularity of Google Cardboard and Google Expeditions. But Cardboard is still kind of in the Oregon Trail stage of virtual reality. It's fun, it's novel, it's great, but it's kind of limited in what it can actually accomplish. Students have few choices in what to do and where they go. And someday we're going to get nostalgic about it, and we're going to laugh about how excited we were for something that is kind of not that cool. But for now, it is cool. And for now, it is exciting. And for now, it is something different. But here's the thing. Virtual reality is becoming cheaper, and it's becoming more and more sophisticated. Within the next few years, we will see virtual reality gaming systems becoming more and more mainstream. It will be interesting to see what this means as far as our concept of space and time and reality. How will schools utilize this beyond the occasional field trips? And will students have the chance to be makers and creators in virtual reality spaces, or will it simply reinforce the consumer culture? Number four, worldview by algorithm. This is a shift we are already seeing. In fact, it's been around for a while. And as we move toward data mining and targeted marketing, social media streams create even tighter and tighter echo chambers. You can see this in the blue feed, red feed experience from the Wall Street Journals. I didn't realize how liberal my news feed is, and I am kind of liberal, I'll just put this out there. Until I saw this and I realized just how biased my news was on a regular basis. And that's how social media works. It filters what we see. And these filters move us further and further and further toward what we already believe, because companies have an incentive to provide content that we will like, share, and comment on. If we don't share it, then that means we leave, and that means we don't like it, and that means it's not worth their time. If I go on Facebook and I see a bunch of stuff I disagree with or I like and it bothers me, I'm not going to go there again. But if I see a lot of what I agree with, I'm going to spend more time there because it's going to be more fun for me. And so that's how it works. We end up in these echo chambers. Now, this coincides with another trend, and that's narrowcasting. It's the opposite of broadcasting, and it's where people find and send specific, highly tailorized, specialized content to niche or niche markets, however you say it. I've heard it both ways. I'm not sure the right way. But anyway, in the past, students held worldviews based on physical geography and social relationships. While those still hold true, there is an added layer of this thing where algorithms are sorting, categorizing, and shaping how they view the world. And it's not just shaping how they view the world, but it's shaping a very narrow worldview. And that's kind of a bad thing, because it makes us less empathetic. People are quick to point to data mining and the death of privacy online, but I think the stronger force here is actually the way that algorithms shape our beliefs about the world. Now, this isn't entirely bad. Physical geography and social institutions can create worldviews that are just as myopic as the narrow-casting worldviews of the algorithm. But it's important to realize that a student's definition of reality and normalcy and their values and their sense of what it means to be human and all of that, it's being shaped in large part by algorithms, by these equations of getting this content to that person who already agrees with it. And it's created by these algorithms where the chief goal is to increase ad revenue. And that can be dangerous because that can sometimes lead to an obsession with things that are novel and amusing, but not necessarily deep. This is all the more reason to have open conversations in schools. It's why critical thinking is so valuable in the classroom. And it's why empathy, a key idea in design thinking, is more valuable than ever. We need broad ideas. We need deeper understanding of one. All right, number five is augmented reality. So augmented reality isn't new. And the idea is simple. The phone adds a layer of reality above the reality that you see in front of you. That's how it works. A few years back, Google Glass... The word Google is one of the hardest words for me to say, and I screw it up all the time. So again, a few years back, Google Glass allowed people to add a constant layer of new reality right before their eyes. I mean, literally right in front of their eyes. And it didn't take off. People mocked Google Glass, calling it the people glass holes. People questioned ethical issues of privacy, and fear began to set in. And suddenly restaurants and places like that began banning these devices. And eventually Google had to let the entire project go, which is sort of the Google way of doing things. Just like they're getting rid of Google Hangouts. It's just what they do. Or I should say Google Hangouts on Air. However, it didn't hit mainstream until last summer. Suddenly, I saw kids running around our neighborhood in 113-degree weather, chasing after a Rapidash just around the corner. Pokemon Go was everywhere. And this was sort of the defining moment when augmented reality hit mainstream. And you're already seeing augmented reality affect learning with apps that allow people to scan math problems and look at potential solutions or tutorials. Museums and historical locations have created AR apps that allow people to see a layer of information on top of what they're seeing in front of them. And it will be interesting to see what this means for school. How will we leverage AR? And at the same time, how will we think critically about the way AR continues to reshape our concept of reality? Number six, artificial intelligence. Not the crappy movie with, Stanley Kubrick's last movie? It was awful. But the robot kid, and I think it was Haley Joel Osment that played it. Anyway, let's get focused. Number six, artificial intelligence. Growing up, I believed artificial intelligence would lead to robots and androids, and I imagined it would look like Data from Star Wars. I can't believe I almost said Star Wars. Data from Star Trek TNG. I would never confuse those. By the way, every time someone says data-driven, that's literally what I picture. I always picture Data driving the Enterprise. But anyway, it was hard to tell. My thought was that it would someday become, you know, hard to tell who's a robot and who's a person, and it might look like the Terminator and all that. But that hasn't been the case at all. Artificial intelligence has gotten super, super popular, and it has nothing to do with robots. Instead, artificial intelligence has been more like a system or a service. We use AI when we talk to Siri or when we do a simple Google search. We use it when we have a smart refrigerator or, you know, a self-driving car. And in many respects, AI has become more like integrative thinking and less like a tool or a product. it's not external. It is, but it feels very internal because it's so interactive with us. And more importantly, it's very, very abstract. It's a layer added to the things we already use. In fact, devices, quote, talking to each other is one of the biggest examples that you see of AI. However, the advent of AI presents some interesting challenges in education. For example, in an era of self-driving cars, who decides the value of life and what does that mean for schools? Suddenly, philosophy is now really, really important and really, really critical and practical. What does this mean to have an original thought when you're using artificial intelligence and you can't tell what is yours and what is the AI? What does this mean for things like plagiarism and copyright? Now, we already have companies using AI to write news articles, and we'll see an increase in AI products around budgeting and other analytical jobs. It would seem then that the humanities will become more and more relevant, and that divergent thinking and creativity will become that much more critical in the future. So if we remain obsessed with taking tests and things like that, we will continue to create irrelevance in schools. Number 7, rapid prototyping. A few months back, Amos Dedley, a college student, printed his own braces with a 3D printer. It raised an interesting question around patent law and 3D printing. But it was also a reminder that 3D printers have done to physical objects what Napster did to the CDs in the music industry. In the past, it was nearly impossible to copy something that had been manufactured. That was always something that was separate. And so although you could easily copy digital things, physical things were still something different. But that's changed. You now have people 3D printing customized equipment like machine parts, often doing this illegally. The 3D printer opens up tons of opportunities to create realistic prototypes. And that's a critical thing for classes with design thinking because prototyping is one of the components. But it also creates challenges for things like intellectual property and manufacturing. These are things to think about as schools embrace makerspaces and STEM classes. What does it mean to be a critical, creative thinker and at the same time be a digital citizen who respects patent laws? What does it mean when a 3D printer can transform ideas and plans into actual objects? What does this mean for students who want to be entrepreneurs? It's exciting, but it's also a little bit frightening. So how do we help students navigate ideas around patent law while also fostering creativity and innovation in engineering? So what do? On some level, we are still trying to adapt to these changes in schools. Some districts have responded with fear by banning devices and creating scare tactics around things like cyberbullying. Other districts have blindly embraced technology by implementing personalized learning systems and ignoring the need for technology criticism. But I can't help but wonder if the best response is actually humility. Maybe we should admit that these changes are huge and they are often hard to understand, but that's okay. Maybe we should embrace the power of technology, but also think critically about the dangers of the power that we possess. It has me thinking that maybe what students need in the future are the same things that they needed in the past. These are the things that are actually timeless. They're the things that will never fade away. And they're more vital right now than they ever have been before. These are things like empathy and wisdom and creativity and critical thinking. If we get that right, they'll be able to make sense out of a world that is constantly changing. And maybe, just maybe, they'll even be able to thrive within it. So, thank you for listening to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm John Spencer. The music is from binsound.com. They have great music to use in presentations, things like that. They are not a sponsor. I'm just citing where I got it from. Great Creative Commons music on that site. Hey, huge favor to ask. If you enjoy this podcast and you liked that last series on student choice, you're excited about this series on the future of learning, could you leave a review on iTunes? That would mean the world to me. And that would also, more importantly, help people find this podcast. So if you could do that, I would really, really appreciate that. Thanks. Have a great day.